Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest today, Norman Finkelstein, whose new book, This Time We Went Too Far, his analysis of the Israeli invasion of Gaza in late 2008, was just published by OR Books. Before that, and before the usual comments in the news, a big thank you is in order to all you KPFA listeners who pledged during our recent fund drive, and especially to those of you who pledged during Behind the News. You're what keeps us going. If you took the Bill Me Later option, please don't forget to send your check. But thank you again. Okay, some words in the economic news. It's cheering that the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico has led to a shift in U.S. public opinion, although you do have to wonder how durable a turn it is. Gallup reports that 55% of Americans would give a higher priority to protecting the environment than to developing domestic energy supplies, and 39% would favor energy development at the expense of the environment. A 16-point gap in favor of the environment. That's a shift from just 2 months ago, when 50% rated domestic energy development a higher priority than protecting the environment, versus 43% favoring nature, a 7-point spread in favor of energy. That March result was the culmination of a trend that's been developing over the last several years. Back in 2007, the environment had a 24-point advantage over energy. That switched to a 7-point advantage in favor of energy in March of this year. We're now back to a 16-point spread in nature's favor. It's sad that a disaster of this magnitude was required to shift public opinion. All of the move, I should say, a result of Democrats and independents shifting their views, Republicans remain as adamantly devoted to the drill, baby, drill agenda as ever. The shift in public opinion in the years before the spill reflect two things, I suspect. One is that recessions typically lead people to put narrowly economic concerns first, and conversely, it seems that people get greener after a long economic expansion. And second, there's been a growing skepticism on climate issues, partly reflecting the recession, but also reflecting the so-called ClimateGate emails, an embarrassment that anti-environmental propagandists cynically use to cast doubt on climate science and scientists. For those of us like me who fear that we're stumbling towards a climate catastrophe, these shifts in public opinion, which Mark Hertzgaard weirdly tried to deny in a recent issue of The Nation, are very depressing. Gallup didn't use the word independence in its polling, that is, as in energy independence. My guess is that if they had, the results might have been different, more skewed towards energy and away from the environment. The whole trope of energy independence is toxic nonsense. It's used by propagandists to grease the way for all kinds of destructive stuff, not just drilling in the Gulf or the Arctic, but also mining coals by blowing up mountains and the like. Why should we be energy independent? Why is radical autonomy considered a virtue anyway? Most KPFA listeners would find it offensive when that sort of insularity is used to bash immigrants and defend nativism. Why doesn't that sort of cosmopolitanism extend to the economic realm? We're not about to become self-sufficient in coffee or consumer electronics. What's so magic about oil? The debate should be about environmental sustainability, not autonomy. That's the real reason to develop renewable energy sources like wind and solar, things that are well within the realm of existing technology, it's important to emphasize. A lot of Greens have pandered to the independence lobby, some of them no doubt because they share a naderish passion for self-sufficiency, but some of them just because it simplifies the sales effort. Both are serious mistakes. Once that leak is finally plugged, and aerial and underwater shots of oil aren't all over the TV and the web, it will be too easy for the independence obsession to regain the upper hand, and the drill baby drill party to reap the political gains. We have become rather dependent on oil from the Gulf. It supplies about 8% of U.S. daily oil consumption, and the offshore reserves are equal to about 5 years of U.S. demand. Of course, it would be nearly painless to cut U.S. energy consumption by more than 8%. More fuel-efficient cars, insulation, turning lights off, all that easy low-hanging stuff. But we're not doing it, or are we about to? I hope that this disaster in the Gulf of Mexico might inspire us to do better. As horrible as it is, were that to happen, were it to be the proverbial wake-up call, it would end up to be a good thing in the long run. But the status quo has a lot of gravitational appeal. Now, I feel guilty, after all those quasi-apocalyptic musings, to step back into the realm of the quotidian, if not the status quo, but that is where we live, alas. So to this week's review of the state of the recovery. Yes, the recovery continues to recover. Sales of houses, both new and existing, were strong in April, with both measures gaining in the high single digits. Sales were given a major boost by the expiring tax credit for first-time buyers. It will be very interesting to see how much of this recent strength carries into May. Some indicators, however, have been looking a little weaker lately. Retail sales have slowed some from their strongish pace earlier this spring. Business spending on capital goods, the motor of long-term economic growth, was weak in April. And surveys of manufacturing have also revealed a slowing pace after some pretty strong numbers earlier this year. First-time claims for unemployment insurance, filed by people who've just lost their jobs, were off by 14,000 last week, but the flattish trend of the last couple of months continued. And the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, designed to forecast movements in the broad economy several months out, fell for the third consecutive week. It's still consistent with a recovery, but a slowing one. And if these falls continue, the whole recovery scenario would be in doubt. Putting all this together, I'd say, it's a picture of an economy that's recovering from a terrible trauma, but one that's still battered and wobbly, and likely to stay that way for months to come. But there are threats to that scenario. I'm not as worried about the European financial crisis knocking us for a loop as some analysts are. We just don't export that much to the EU, and unless the financial crisis gets considerably worse, the freeze-up in the European credit markets isn't likely to hurt the U.S. very much. So far, this is mainly a European affair. More worrisome from a domestic U.S. point of view are the growing pressures for austerity. Obama's deficit commission is almost certain to recommend cuts in Medicare and Social Security, along with other non-military spending. That will both hurt actual people and act as a major drag on the macroeconomy. Isn't it amazing how easily Congress can approve funding for the Afghanistan war, as it just did the other day, without ever asking how it's going to be paid for, but a job creation bill is dying precisely because of such questions. Lots of money for death, no questions asked, but not much for life. And job creation schemes do work, and God knows we need it, even despite this modest recovery. Just the other day, the Congressional Budget Office, a very reliable source, estimated that the stimulus package, officially known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, knocked about 1.5 points off the unemployment rate and saved or created about 2 million jobs. That is, it made things considerably less bad than they turned out to be. But all that stimulus spending will wane as the year goes on. Does the economy have enough of its own juice to carry on, or will it sink back into the vortex of despair as the fiscally responsible sadomonetarists cheer the move towards budget balance? Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Norman Finkelstein. That was some of Alban Berg's Variations for Piano, Opus 27, performed by Glenn Gould. My only guest on today's show is Norman Finkelstein, whose latest book is This Time We Went Too Far, his analysis of Israel's invasion of Gaza at the end of 2008, and his surprisingly hopeful reading of changing U.S. public opinion towards Israel, especially among younger Jews. This book is just published by OR Books. Norman is also the author of Image and Reality in the Israel-Palestine Conflict, The Holocaust Industry, both of those published by Verso, and Beyond Chutzpah, published by the University of California Press. This interview was recorded in a somewhat noisy apartment in Manhattan earlier this week. Apologies for the occasional oral distraction. Norman Finkelstein. Welcome, Norman. First, let's just start with a prehistory of the invasion. How did Gaza get to be one of the most godforsaken patches of earth on the planet?
Well, the main reason is what happened in 1948 when Israel expelled the indigenous population from what became Israel. A large number of the refugees ended up fleeing to Gaza. So by the end of the 1948 war, I think it was about 80% of Gaza's population consisted of refugees. And then on top of that, no doubt because the population is confined to the refugee camps, it's a very high rate of population growth. So about half of the Gaza population is under 16 years old. And then beyond that, the occupation took a big toll in Gaza. The world's leading authority in Gaza's economy is the Harvard political economist, Sarah Roy. And she wrote a definitive study on Gaza. It was called The Redevelopment of Gaza. And Israel introduced policies, economic policies, which were basically designed to wreck the Gaza economy and make the population dependent on working in Israel.
So what then was the reason for the invasion end of 2008? Let's start with the political strategy that Israel had behind this invasion.
Well, in my opinion, the invasion didn't have much to do with Gaza. The invasion had much more to do with what happened in Lebanon in the summer of 2006. Israel suffered a major military defeat in Lebanon at the hands of the Party of God, the Hezbollah. And Israel was worried after the defeat it suffered that what it called its deterrence capacity had been significantly diminished. Deterrence capacity is just a fancy technical term for the Arab world's fear of Israel. And Israel was worried that the Arab world no longer feared it. The head of the Party of God, Sheikh Nasrallah, kept giving these speeches in which he taunted the Israelis and said, "The Arabs are no longer afraid of you. Go ahead and attack again. We'll defeat you again."
The balance of forces in Lebanon was very much in Israel's favor on paper, right? But they still lost.
Yeah, well, Israel had amassed a significant army and was prepared to deal a significant blow to the Party of God. But they suffered a huge defeat. They had assembled about 30,000 to 40,000 soldiers. The Hezbollah consisted of several thousand. And in fact, Israel didn't even face the crack Hezbollah troops who were stationed along the Litani waiting for the Israeli invasion. The Israeli army was basically defeated by villagers on the border, village militias on the border with Israel. And so now Israel needed a place to restore what it calls its deterrence capacity. It didn't yet have a military option against the Hezbollah. And so around 2008, it was focusing on an attack on Iran with the U.S.'s backing, of course. The U.S. vetoed it. So now the only place Israel could restore its deterrence capacity was in Gaza, because Gaza also presented itself with a certain amount of defiance and bravado like the Hezbollah, and it claimed the victory for Israel's redeployment in 2005. And so Israel felt here was the place it could restore the Arab world's fear of it. But it had one major problem. The problem is everybody knew that Hamas wasn't a fighting force, that it was not equipped to defeat an army. And so how do you restore your deterrence capacity? How do you get the Arab world to fear you when your foe is not a matching military force? And what Israel decided to do, and they were quite upfront about it, especially after the attack, what they decided to do was, and now I'm quoting Israeli officials, to act like a mad dog and to act a lunatic, which is what they did in Gaza, to act like a mad dog, to act lunatic, or as the foreign minister Tzipi Livni said during the invasion, to go wild, in order to communicate to the Arab world that if you get out of hand, it's not going to be a conventional war. We're just going to go in and destroy everything in sight, which is what they did in Gaza.
What was the military strategy? How'd they go about doing that?
Well, there wasn't really a military strategy. I think the main misconception, the main misapprehension, and in effect the main propaganda device is to call what happened in Gaza a war. There was no war in Gaza. After the invasion was over, Israel was boasting and going around saying, now we've shown the Arabs who's who and what's what. We've cut the Arabs down to size. We've put the uppity Arabs in place, because they said, we won the war in Gaza. We won the war in Gaza. But then the Israeli military or strategic analyst, he said, it's very dangerous for Israel to go around saying it won the war when there was no war in Gaza. There was no, as he said, there wasn't a single battle fought in the 22 days of fighting in Gaza. One Israeli soldier described it as, he said, it was like PlayStation 2 computer game. Everything was done by remote control. And another Israeli soldier said, it was like a child with a magnifying glass burning ants. As a matter of fact, virtually every soldier who was interviewed conveyed the same experience. Never saw an Arab. Never contacted Hamas. Never had any tangle with the foe. There were no battles in Gaza. What happened in Gaza was, as one soldier after another said, especially if you look at the Israeli publication Breaking the Silence, which is composed of testimonies of Israeli soldiers, one soldier after another said, Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza.
Over the course of 3 weeks, I mean, what did they do over the course of relentlessly pummeling this rather small patch of ground over the course of 3 weeks? What did they accomplish in that 3 weeks?
Well, I'm not sure if accomplish is the right word. It's what did they destroy in those 22 days of what Amnesty International called the 22 days of death and destruction. The Goldstone report, it said that Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population. That's word for word, verbatim, what it said. And that's, in effect, what it did. It targeted all of the civilian infrastructure in Gaza, destroyed the only operative flour mill, the Al-Badr flour mill, destroyed the chicken farms, sent in tanks, which just ran over the chickens, killed in one family. There were a family of four brothers, I think it was the Al-Siafari family, killed 100,000 chickens. It attacked the hospitals, damaged or destroyed 15 hospitals, destroyed 30 mosques, damaged 15 more mosques, schools, universities. It destroyed the entire civilian infrastructure in Gaza, and also a large number of civilians were killed, between 1,000 and 1,200 civilians were killed during the attack.
What you're describing sounds like state terrorism on a very grand scale.
Well, as I said, the Goldstone Report, although it was the most cautious, careful, and judicious of the large number of human rights reports that came out, it did use the word, a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Well, if its aim is to terrorize, then it's engaging in terrorism. That seems to be fairly straightforward. And the only thing I would add is it had, as I said at the beginning, it had nothing to do with Gaza. They were terrorizing Gaza in order to restore their deterrence capacity elsewhere in the Arab world. That's what makes it so doubly sickening what happened to Gaza. They were just being used as a demonstration bloodbath to communicate to the rest of the Arab world to stay in line.
Obviously, chickens are no security threat. Deliberately targeting civilians and a civilian infrastructure is a war crime under conventional definitions.
Well, just one comment about the chickens. About two or three days ago, I debated the Israeli historian Benny Morris on Russian television, and he said, as all Israeli propagandists say, that Israel attacked Hamas infrastructure. So I said, really, were those chickens Hamas infrastructure? And he laughed and he said, well, maybe they were Hamas chickens. It's all a joke for them to wreck and destroy the lives of the Palestinians, to deprive them of their staples, deprive them of bread, deprive them of eggs. For the Israelis, he had no shame. I mean, actually, people were quite shocked because many people commented on the program because it's available on YouTube. They were just really shocked at the sheer, you know, the brutishness of the Israelis. When you say, is it a war crime? Yeah, all the human rights reports, including the most recent one, came out about a week and a half ago from Human Rights Watch. It was called I Lost Everything, and it describes the systematic destruction of parts of Gaza using quite compelling evidence. What they did was they examined the satellite photographs of what Gaza looked like before and after Israel had full control over the territory. So a lot of the destruction occurred in the last week of the Israeli invasion, when Israel had complete and total control of certain areas. And when it had the complete and total control, that's when it went in, demolished the homes, demolished the factories.
The apologists or defenders of Israel will say that this was an appropriate act of self-defense for the merciless rocket attacks to come across the border. Tell us about the rocket attacks. What do you make of that excuse?
Well, there's a simple reply to that question. There was a ceasefire in place. It began June 19th, 2008, and the terms of the ceasefire were reciprocal. It was negotiated by Egypt or brokered by Egypt. Hamas was supposed to stop its rocket and mortar attacks in Israel, and Israel was supposed to gradually lift its blockade of Gaza, a blockade which Amnesty International called a flagrant violation of international law, a blockade which the Goldstone Report later said is a possible crime against humanity. So Israel had its obligation to gradually lift the blockade. Now, according to Israel's own Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I'm quoting it now, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Hamas was careful to to maintain the ceasefire. But Israel reneged on its obligation to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza. And then what happened next has been amply documented on November 4th, when all the eyes of Americans and the media was riveted to the result of the U.S. election. On November 4th, Israel attacked Gaza and killed six Hamas militants, knowing full well that this invasion would cause a collapse of the ceasefire. And in fact, Israel wanted the ceasefire to end because it had planned the invasion of Gaza already as early as March 2007. Now all the pieces were in place. It needed a pretext. And Israel does as it always does. It goes in, provokes, knowing full well that the provocation will not be reported here, but the Hamas reaction to the provocation will be reported. And so Hamas resumed the rocket attacks, which is what Israel wanted, but Hamas kept saying, till the end of December, we want to renew the ceasefire. We're ready to renew the ceasefire. All Israel has to do is agree to implement the terms of the original agreement to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza. Israel refused. Of course it refused, because it wanted a rocket attack. In fact, the Israeli papers reported that, and I'm quoting them, the only reason Barak agreed to the ceasefire that began on June 19th is because they said he needed more time to prepare the attack.
Another standard response from the defenders of Israel would be that Hezbollah and Hamas are horrendous organizations, Jew haters dedicated to the destruction of Israel, and that Israel is correct in responding with overwhelming violence just out of self-defense.
Well, Hamas has repeatedly said it's ready to settle the conflict in the June 67 border. The head of Hamas, Khalid Meshaal, he said that before the attack, and he said it even the week after the Israeli massacre in Gaza. He said, we're ready to settle the June 67 border. And Hezbollah has said, whatever Hamas agrees to, we'll accept. Hezbollah said, we accepted it when Egypt entered into a peace treaty with Israel. So if you want to settle the conflict according to the terms of international law, There are people available. Whether that means they will stop hating each other, probably not. But the United States and the Soviet Union had relations for many years, had diplomatic relations for many years, notwithstanding the fact that there were basic ideological and strategic conflicts. Countries are not obliged in our world system. They're not obliged to love each other. They're just obliged to live by the rules of the game. And the rules of the game are pretty much spelled out in Article 2 of the UN Charter. You're not allowed to use threats, that it's illegal for there to be threats or use of force against member states. That's it.
I'm speaking with Norman Finkelstein, author of This Time We Went Too Far, just published by OR Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. More Norman Finkelstein after this musical break.
Thank you.
That was some of the first of six studies for string quartet written by the 17-year-old T.W. Adorno, performed by the Leipzig String Quartet. Yes, that was a bit of the later gloomy social philosopher as a teenage atonalist. Back now to Norman Finkelstein, author of This Time We Went Too Far, just published by O.R. Books.
Several times you mentioned the Goldstone Report is often vilified as a self-hating Jew. Tell us about Richard Goldstone's background and his qualifications for issuing this report.
Well, Goldstone is a distinguished South African jurist. He sat on South Africa's constitutional court, the equivalent of our Supreme Court, and then he went on to be the chief prosecutor for the International War Crimes Tribunals in the former Yugoslavia and and Rwanda. So he has a distinguished record. When the report was issued, and it was very critical of Israel, the Israeli establishment across the board, including Shimon Peres, Sir Shimon, he was knighted, Sir Shimon, the Prince of Peace in Israel. He called Goldstone a small man who didn't know anything about international law. Israel's ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, some people think he's a historian, he said the Goldstone report was worse than Ahmadinejad and the Holocaust deniers. Alan Dershowitz said that Goldstone is an evil, evil man, that the report was like the protocols of the elders of Zion, and on and on. You can only imagine how indignant he would have been if he actually read the report. And the interesting question with Goldstone is, why did the Israelis become so outraged? Because the Goldstone report was the last, and at this point, probably around 20 very substantial human rights reports on what happened in Gaza. Amnesty International published two large reports. Human Rights Watch published to date seven reports on what happened in Gaza. Then there were Israeli human rights organizations, Palestinian human rights organizations, international fact-finding missions, international expert missions. So there's a huge accumulation. The Goldstone report was probably the most cautious, careful, and judicious of all the reports. So why the hysteria over Goldstone? And the answer is not very hard to find. Goldstone is not only Jewish, but he is by his own avowals a committed Zionist. He said, I've worked for Israel my whole adult life. He sits on the board of governors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He has an honorary doctorate from the Hebrew University. His mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. His daughter did Zionist emigration to Israel. He said he believes in the absolute right of the Jewish state to be there. And when he was asked why he became a human rights prosecutor, he said it was because of the Nazi Holocaust. And so now Israel had a real problem on its hands, because for the past several decades, it's honed, it's perfected these ideological weapons in order to discredit criticism of Israeli policy. So if you criticize Israel, you must be an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew or a Holocaust denier. But now along comes Richard Goldstone, and in his person and in his persona, or his professional life, in his person and his professional life, he neutralized these weapons. As the Israeli columnist Gideon Levy put it, he said, this time the messenger, meaning Goldstone, this time the messenger is propaganda proof. Goldstone didn't appear to be your typical anti-Semite. He didn't seem to be your usual self-hating Jew. He says, I'm a Zionist. I love Israel. And he wasn't your run-of-the-mill Holocaust denier, because he said, it's because of the Holocaust that I became a human rights lawyer in the first place. So if he was not a self-hating Jew, a Holocaust denier, if he was not an incompetent, and he was not a fool, then there was only one possible explanation for the devastating content of the report he wrote. And the only possible explanation was, it was true. And so now Israel had a huge problem on its hands. Actually, Netanyahu, quote, one of the three most dangerous threats facing Israel. The first was Ahmadinejad. The second was the Goldstone Report. I forgot the third. And to this day, they can't figure out what to do with it. They've gotten pretty ugly in their attacks on Goldstone. A couple of weeks ago, they tried to prevent him from attending his grandson's bar mitzvah. And they dredged up his past during the apartheid era in South Africa to discredit him, compare him now to Nazis. There are two things. They don't amuse me, but let's call it, they bemuse me. Number one, a lot of people have criticized me and I've said the reason I've come under so much attack in my professional life and personal life is because of my style. I have this aggressive, belligerent, provocative, incendiary style. So I have to, as I said, I have to look on at what's happening to Goldstone with bemusement, because he has a very understated style. He's sort of the opposite of me. It hasn't protected him from being called a self-hating Jew, from being compared to Nazis, and all the rest. So that would seem to suggest that it's not style that was the cause of my difficulties in my professional life.
You'd be tempted, if you wanted to psychoanalyze a whole culture, to think that these intense and hysterical reactions are a symptom of a sense that things are slipping away, that Israel is really badly losing the, well, certainly not very popular in the outside world, but even in the United States, we're seeing a shift in public opinion, elite public opinion, even away from Israel. Not letting Noam Chomsky into the country the other day, I think, has caused some embarrassment to Israel. I mean, then, of course, this horribly brutal war has discredited the country. This horribly brutal massacre. Yeah, you quote an officer saying, your epigraph is quoting an officer saying, well, I'm not saying go out and create a massacre, but
yeah.
I mean, it was clear go out and create a massacre was their orders.
Exactly.
He just didn't want to be. The massacre of Gaza and not letting Noam Chomsky into the country are different events of a very different order, but it does suggest that Israel's really losing something, and the defenses are getting more hysterical, and when you have people like Dershowitz really amping up the volume too, that they feel like they're losing something. Is that a correct interpretation?
The problem is, they are losing, and they know they're losing the battle of public opinion. You can't really defend Israel on a college campus anymore, and no students really try.
I was stunned to learn that a bunch of students walked out at the Brandeis campus when Dershowitz started to speak, and the Student Senate refused to pass a resolution honoring Israel's 60th birthday.
Yeah, and that's Brandeis.
What's going on?
Well, what's going on is, as everybody knows, Jews are overwhelmingly liberal. 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama in the election. Among Latinos, it was about 67%. Among whites in general, it was about 43%. If you factor in income, with Jews being by far and away the wealthiest ethnic group in the United States, then Jews should be voting overwhelmingly Republican. But no, Jews are liberal. And to be liberal, it means supporting international institutions, supporting the rule of law, supporting human rights. Amnesty International is a liberal organization. Human Rights Watch is a liberal organization. Jews being overwhelmingly liberal, and the fact that human rights organizations have been in the forefront of criticizing and condemning Israeli conduct, it's no longer possible to be liberal, which Jews overwhelmingly are, and to defend Israel. If you're a student on a college campus, you're probably even more liberal than your parents. That's just the nature of being young and idealistic. So what are you going to do? Israel dropped white phosphorus on Al-Quds Hospital. It dropped white phosphorus on Al-Wafa Hospital. White phosphorus reaches a temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. If you're a young Jewish student in the college campus, can you defend that? Is it defensible? And so, you know, I speak quite a lot in college campuses. I just came back from a fairly intense speaking tour. And I went with two young British people, one a British Iraqi rap artist, Loki, he's 23, and another a 19-year-old wheelchair-bound journalist named Jody McIntyre. And they thought that going on this speaking tour in the U.S., they would be going into the lion's den. But in fact, there was no opposition. I always end our presentation by saying, I invite dissenters to come out first, because they patiently listen to us. Now let them have a say. I say, come on up. I'll give you the microphone. It doesn't even have to be a question. You can make a statement. Nobody comes. Nobody wants to dissent. The only place there was dissent was at Irvine, University of California, Irvine, where there was recently a teapot tempest when Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador, came to speak, and some students verbally objected. So there was an event before the main event in the evening. There was an event on a campus quad outside, and there was a substantial contingent with banners and all the regalia to defend Israel. But they were all 50 or more years older. They were just community people. I had to begin by saying that this is not bingo night at the Senior Citizen Center. You know, this is serious business. And we should conduct ourselves that way. But other than that, there were no demonstrations. There was nothing.
And the polling is also showing that, especially among younger Jews, Israel is losing all salience in their thinking, right?
Yeah, there's what the Jewish establishment calls a distancing of younger American Jews from Israel, because there's, in my opinion, the main reason is that it's indefensible what Israel is doing. They don't have memories of the, so to speak, inspirational Israel, the Israel of the kibbutzim, the Israel of reasonably honest leaders. I mean, their leaders were ruthless, and they were thugs, but they were honest, and they were committed. You know, the Ben-Gurion generation, the Abba Eben generation. You know, you take someone like Abba Eben, he graduated with triple honors from Cambridge, hadn't done anything with his life, but he chose to dedicate himself, and that's the right word, dedicate himself to this piddling movement called Zionism. You know, before Israel became a shaker in the world, these were very dedicated people. Now, I mean, there's barely a figure in the Israeli government who's not under indictment. So the society has become so shabby, so corrupt, so ugly, that younger Jews who have no memories of the inspirational days, there's just nothing there.
It's also turned into something of an oligarchy, right? Just a handful of families own a lot of the productive apparatus.
Israel has the highest maldistribution of wealth in the industrialized world after the United States.
This changing in nature of public opinion in the United States doesn't seem to be reflective yet in U.S. government policy. What do you make, you know, whenever a Democrat takes over, there's a lot of nostalgia for the peace process and Oslo and Camp David and all that. What do you see and expect from the Obama administration on policy towards Israel?
I have no expectations from the Obama administration. It was clear, and I said so at the very beginning, that his foreign policy advisors were basically holdovers from the Clinton era, some from the Bush era. So to expect any kind of fundamental shift in policy was not really realistic, especially since President Obama's political instincts are always to appease the powers that be. And that was clear even in the economic situation where he couldn't even reach out to a Paul Volcker. He was so establishment-oriented in his economic policies. And the same thing in his foreign policy. So there was no reason to have expectations. Politics has different levels. There's one level, which you can call the basic level, is trying to persuade and win over public opinion. That's the first challenge. The second challenge is to harness that public opinion and turn it into a political force. And then the third challenge is, you know, to reach the real centers of power. And we're still at the first level. There is a shift in public opinion. But now I think the main thing that has to be done is what my good friend Alan Nairn said, that there's this huge gap between J Street on the one hand and what you can call Palestinian purists and fundamentalists on the other hand. And then there's this huge swath of land between them. And we need a lobby to mobilize that huge swath.
At the end of the book, you have a Catholic, small c, approach to this political movement. You're willing to accept all kinds of folks into it as long as it accomplishes the goal of humanizing policy, right?
Yeah, because I don't see any point in ideological litmus tests. I don't care if you are now or ever have been a Zionist. I think they're just basic principles of international law, of justice and decency, to resolve the conflict. And if you agree with those principles, then you're welcome. I don't see the point of litmus tests that are going to exclude Richard Goldstone and Noam Chomsky because both of them call themselves Zionists. I don't see the point in that. I don't care if you're a Zionist. I want to know where you stand on the precepts, the principles for resolving the conflict. And if you accept the basic principles that have been endorsed by virtually every state in the UN General Assembly, that have been endorsed by the human rights organizations, that have been endorsed by the International Court of Justice, if you accept those principles, then you're welcome. As Edward Said used to say at the end of his life, quoting the Caribbean poet M.A. Cesar, he would say there's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. And I think that's right. There's room for everyone. Just be fair. Just be reasonable. Just allow for other people that same claim on human dignity that you want for yourself. And that if you're reasonable and if you're principled and you're reasonable. Now, I'm pretty tough on the principle. I agree with Gandhi. He often used to say, I'm all for compromise, but not when it comes to principles. Because when you start giving up principles, he said, it becomes all give and no take. And that's right. The principles are out there. Israel has to fully withdraw from the territories it occupied in June 1967. There has to be a resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. Those are the principles that the entire international community has endorsed, what you might call enlightened public opinion. And the Palestinians are under no obligation to forfeit any of their rights under international law. But having said that, I don't want to say but, and having said that, then we have to be reasonable. We have to show that there is a way out, that there is no inevitability to what's happening now. It's not one of these timeless conflicts that go back to the Bible and all that other crap, you know, about civilizational conflicts and so forth. No, the terms for resolving the conflict are pretty straightforward and remarkably uncomplicated. I've been reading a lot about India, and at the end of the British occupation of India, I have to say it was not very easy to resolve, because the conflict between the Muslim League led by Jinnah and the Congress Party, and the intermixture of the populations, and then there were the princely states, it was pretty messy. As compared to conflicts like that, Israel-Palestine is really not that complicated. If we're reasonable, and I know the Palestinians are capable of being reasonable, if we're principled and we're reasonable, then, or I should say, if you're principled and if you're reasonable, then yeah, I think there's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. And I don't, you know, Israel has turned into a very ugly place. But truth be told, Germany was also a very ugly place almost within my lifetime. And yet, it's quite striking to me that when you look at the polls, the most liked country in the world, the most liked country in the world is Germany. And irony of ironies, you know what's second? It's Japan. Countries can change. I don't believe in this notion of original sin. Of course, residues continue. It's not impossible. It's not really easy to erase the slate clean. But you can change. The American South has changed. I've been doing a lot of reading lately about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, that Deep South was one ugly, scary place. But you know, nowadays, a lot of black people from the North, they return to the South. They say it's more civilized there. Places can change. So we shouldn't demonize Israel and get carried away with this notion of original sin. I mean, for goodness sake, if ever there was a country with original sin born of extermination, expulsion, and slavery, it was this place, the U.S. of A. So we should be the last ones talking about other countries' original sin. And they can improve. Rationally and objectively, there is no grounds for hopelessness. The problem is it's a kind of race against time now, because Israel is destroying itself, and it's destroying Palestine. I mean, in a very physical, real sense, Israel and Palestine are being destroyed. And it may become literal, because, as you know, about 3 months ago, Sheikh Nasrallah gave a speech, and he said, and you have to bear in mind, the leader of Hezbollah, his entire reputation, which is quite high in the Arab world, it rests on one fact, that there is no sunlight between what he says and what he does. The moment a discrepancy, a gap opens up between the two, he knows his popularity is going to plummet. And Nasrallah said to Israel, if you attack Beirut, then we're going to attack Tel Aviv. You destroy Rafik Hariri International Airport, we're going to destroy Ben-Gurion Airport. And that was serious. That's not hot air. And so the stakes are very high now. And it's very easy to imagine a wrong move that can trigger a conflagration. And that brings me back to what you said about Chomsky. The Israelis are not behaving rationally. What they did was really stupid. But it wasn't a stupid initiative of some border guard. As Chomsky repeatedly said, everything that was done was being checked back and forth with the Ministry of Interior over several hours. They're not behaving, even from the point of view of their own self-interest, they're not behaving rationally. They're crazy. And it's unfortunately not far-fetched to imagine that in their crazy desire to restore their deterrence capacity, they're going to trigger something which will get out of control. So we should really all work hard to try to put a stop to this.
And that was Norman Finkelstein, author of This Time We Went Too Far, just out from OR Books. Norman is also the author of Image and Reality in the Israel-Palestine Conflict, The Holocaust Industry, and Beyond Chutzpah. Apologies for all the background noise characteristic of a Manhattan apartment where that interview was recorded earlier this week. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this bit from Revolution by the Iraqi-British rapper Lowkey, who just went on a U.S. tour with Norman Finkelstein to get the word out about Norman's new book and to advance the cause of peace and justice in the Middle East. Till next week, bye.
Little man never did exams, got a particular bigger plan, flipping grams when a bigger man in his gang gave him a stick to bang, or maybe just hold, cause no one thought he would kill a man, till he caught a silly billy villain chilling in the jam, sipping sham, spliffing his hand, triggered in a jam, bang bang, biddy bang, biddy biddy bang, now he's in the can, take it down, what a pity fan, rappers are yapping and flapping their lips, about how they're packing and clapping their sticks, has to be big, the impact it has on the kids, tell me where the factory is, the government killed it, just stacking their chips, you wonder why the youth them are strapped and they're pissed, if not a nine, it's a knife getting jabbed in your roof, people die for the petrol and gas and our whip, in London, you can get shanked in the heart, still the government, more text in a rock. Ignorant little spitters are talking greasy, cause they bitten bits that they saw on TV. If all you rap about is the holes in the dope, it's already too late. You sold them, you sold. You jokers act like you know, but you don't, cause there's little kids dying all over the globe.